David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 354. I'm your host, Steve Raker, plotting nothing short of world domination from the comic book bunker. Andrew and Kevin will also be here, and we've got on deck our third segment covering Nova's original series from the 1970s, followed by an after-hours, late-night, recent reads discussion. Marvel Noise, now in our 14th year of delivering the mighty Marvel magic, is the podcast proudly sponsored by Nobody. You can find episodes to stream and download and an episode archive on marvelnoise.com. We have a Facebook and Twitter page for you to find images that we share and give feedback. And we are proudly part of the Deliberate Noise Network, where that has been our home since the beginning. Our sister show is Indie Comic Book Noise, where we talk about the indie comic books we're digging on, also part of the Deliberate Noise Network. Where else would we be, right? And our friends at the Baltimore Comic Con have decided this year that the 2020 Baltimore Comic Con will be an online event. Information on panels and guests and the like can be found over on BaltimoreComicCon.com. Before we visit the human rocket, I just read Iron Man 2020 number 6 of 6. And it's funny, this finale to Dan Slott's run on Iron Man, one that made Arno Stark and Iron Man 2020 a reality, in this fictional reality at least, it initially doubles down on everything I didn't like about this and some of the previous run. I mean, I liked the Iron Man of 2020 back in the day when he appeared in that Machine Man Limited series with the Trimpy and Winsor Smith art. He was a cool idea with a cool design, an alternate universe future Iron Man who was a bad guy, and he had the gears on his shoulders and the menacing-looking mouthpiece and everything. Then, as 2020 approached in real time, you know, I guess they just couldn't help themselves, and they made Arno Stark a reality in the 616, and I admit, I didn't at all care for how they shoehorned him in. The real Stark son, disabled in an iron lung. Hey, he was an Iron Man too. Ugh. And then the Stark parents returning. Tony was adopted, even. Finding Tony's real mom, and Arno's rise to the top while Tony became an artificial intelligence echo of the real Stark. So when this Iron Man 2020 series hit, Arno became an all-out megalomaniac setting out to enslave all artificial intelligence and wipe out humankind, all to defeat some delusional, paranoid threat which, just as Tony and the robot resistance that he had rounded up rise back up and take it right to Arno in his headquarters, it turns out to be a real threat after all. Like, Arno was right? I didn't like any of this, but somehow this last issue number 6, not only satisfactorily resolves all the plot threads that Slott was managing, but also effectively removes all of these elements that I didn't care for from Iron Man's world, and it's all even done with a clever twist. Arno, the parents, the holographic or whatever armor, that Tony's a bot, and the threat of this singularity is all taken care of. It won't be a bad quick read when it's on Marvel Unlimited. Speaking of reads that are available on Marvel Unlimited, let me connect and get the guys on. All right, I've got Andrew and Kevin on the line so we can jump into our third segment covering the original Nova series from the 70s that I enjoyed as a young lad at that time, pulling these books off the rack. We did part one on Marvel Noise episode 347, covering the first seven issues, and part two was on Marvel Noise 349, where we covered issues 8 through 14, which brings us up to issue 15, covering, we're going to cover 1977 into 1978 here with these books. Thanks for coming back and doing more of this Nova jump.
You couldn't keep me away from Nova. Does that sound convincing?
It's so funny because, I mean, more in the 70s, there were so many sophisticated or attempt at more like adult sophisticated comics that Marvel published. Part of it was because of the laxed code and the ability to do the horror titles. Part of it was because there were creators in charge who were fans of comics rather than stuck doing comics, and they wanted to do their own creative riff on the medium rather than just try to get as many books done as could be done the way that their heroes, the first generation of comic artists, had done. And it was also the era of the writer-editor, right? So there's, like, no checks and balances as there often is between a writer and editorial. So Marv Wolfman, being a writer and editor, who was writing titles like Tomb of Dracula, wanted to make a comic that younger readers could totally just jump in on, like an entry-level book. And he'd keep it simple and introduce lots of new characters. And this was Nova. And we have grown fond of the character from later iterations. And Kevin, you and I have covered the character doing several different books that we've covered in the past, like Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff. And I know you share a fondness for the character. But yet when we've gone back to read these original books, they're not appealing to you that much, right?
Yeah, it's so strange. I don't think I've ever had as big of a disconnect between like the more modern thing and then like the old original. I don't know. It's like they haven't rounded off the edges or it, something. I don't know.
I think a big part of it is that it really wasn't for us adult readers even then. It was, for me, is like a 7 and 8 year old, to be honest. And the fact that it was bi-monthly didn't help. So when you didn't notice the lack of the smoothness between the issues and stuff.
I mean, is there even a coloring error in here where one of the villains is like, look at all the red dots on this map? And I'm like, there are no red dots on that map, dude.
Okay, we've got a lot of time.
I still say they should have called it The Teenager Called Nova, you know, really play up the youth angle, but I guess that didn't fit on the cover.
When Richard Rider, teenager, was blasted by a light bolt from beyond the stars, he suddenly found himself transformed into one of the most powerful men on Earth, invulnerable, able to fly at Nova speed, stronger than any 10 men. The young high school donned the costume of his alien benefactor to become a champion of justice. He's the man called Nova. And we're start with a four-issue arc that spanned Nova issues 15 to 18. And this arc is a great example of the need for a writer to have an editor. Like, the plot is exciting. There's so many twists and turns, but this still needed some revising.
Well, at least I feel Andrew's like favorite new character, Crime Buster, is on the first page.
For me, I feel like Tom Palmer is kind of tamping down some of Carmine's more excesses, because I grew up, my fond sweet spot are those Star Wars mm-hmm. licensed comics that he did, where he just was full on Infantinoing things. So mm-hmm. I like that there's hints of it here, but I feel like Palmer's really kind of reining him in yeah. a little bit.
Well, there's more than hints, and that's the art team is Carmine Infantino and Tom Palmer on most of these issues. And I love like Tom's finishing touches, like when you do the seam along the fingers of the gloves. Man, I think that's a really classy touch.
Yeah, no, it's not meant as a slide. I have a fondness for when Carmine goes all out crazy.
Oh, we definitely see some of that. I'm going to point out some examples. This arc opens with Nova helping his new pal Crime Buster foil acts of larceny by the purple-garbed Crimmins gang.
That was the one that wasn't approved by the editor. They're like, acts of vengeance? That sounds better than acts of larceny.
Crime Buster uses his whammer gun, guys. It can shoot nets, nuts, and probably anything else. And he has a pen and stare. Who knew? Well, watching all this from a distance is another masked perp who is thankful that it's not him down there. But then he proceeds to break and enter and set off an alarm right there within earshot, even though he knows the heroes are there. It sends Nova speeding onto the scene. They tussle, the mask gets ripped off, and it's Rich Rider's, like, Flash Thompson bully equivalent, Mike Burley, who had been missing.
Oh, I thought it was a Sin Eater.
And then
on record as not liking the exclamation Blue Blazes. I really feel like
really
he could have done something with that. It feels so anachronistic, even in the 70s, that, like, I would have just preferred geez or wow or some more generic phrase.
Is it better in the 90s? I'm not sure. Because...
Well, I think in the 90s, it's the 90s are already pretty disconnected from things. So they're, I feel like they're leading into the excesses. So if you want your characters, I mean, there I'd expect some phrase with lots of exclamations and characters modding up, so he's swearing, but it's in comic book form with ampersands and all that after it.
Yeah, it's definitely an obvious attempt to make something be kind of like a memorable thing about the character as they're kind of building this culture around him. I mean, the whole series is so formulaic as far as the structure with the sidekick friends and the girlfriend and you know the bully, the high school stuff, the we'll see that there was a attempt to set up this rogues gallery of villains who then cycle back around and were kind of at it all along and causing some of the other misadventures along the way. Yeah. Well, Mike Burley, now that he's unmasked, he escapes, goes, like, jumping out the window. I thought he was jumping to his death, but no, he runs off. Mm. And now, you know, he was missing, and now he's missing again.
He's a pretty good acrobat, though.
Guess so.
And Nova says, why in blazes, not blue blazes? Is he committing the crime?
Well, I don't always. Because
he just likes sword blazes.
Yeah, I don't always say that, you know. But it's my thing. Meanwhile, Rich's dad, Mr. Ryder, he meets with this secret Long Island organization, the Inner Circle, who they make it clear that they own him after giving him a loan, and now they're going to make him do something probably illegal, which really ruffles Mr. Ryder's striped bow tie there.
Yeah, he's very old school, very like the man takes care of the family. And covers everything. You know, he's got to pay the bills and not worry the family about it and all that. And I thought that was nice to have, like, this school principal buttoned down with a dark side. I thought the father came off as, for a 1970s comic book character, believable.
Nova's flying around, and his spidey sense goes off. He's got this red Nova signal on his helmet, that little symbol thing, and it lights up and pulses, and then it gives him the police scanner reports. Which...
Oh, one other thing, Steve, I love the little jokes they put in. I can see how people might hate him. We're going to see a lot of that. Like when Rich is studying, like all his books are subject made simple.
Yeah. Well, that was Wolfman's thing, that he was going to make Rich like Spider-Man and Peter Parker, but not give him the super genius part of Peter Parker, which really leaves him lacking in a few different circumstances when he comes across technology and it's like, well, I don't know really how to do anything with this, so maybe I'll just smash it.
Yeah, I just like the light, like you could show that, but they're going to have all these sight gags that someone had to go pencil in throughout this run, and I appreciated it.
The police report that he gets pulsed in through his helmet is pretty vague. There's something crazy happening at LaGuardia. And what is going on at LaGuardia? Nova never really finds out, really, because he's blindside punched by Iron Man.
Like, oh no.
In the back of the head.
And then the Hulk jumps on his back?
Spider-Man attacks. But, you know, they know each other from the crossover event that we talked about in our last segment, the one on episode 349.
And you get to see this art team take their crack at all these classic Marvel characters. We just need to add, like, Thor or something.
It's funny you should mention that, but I'll get to that later when all this gets unraveled. Iron Man punches Nova in the gut. It's like, body blow, body blow. And Nova can't believe it, so he flees. The Hulk lands on him, follows up with a Hulk-sized haymaker. Captain America joins in, hits Nova with his shield. Nova flies away again and is attacked into Shea Stadium while it's packed with fans and a game is on. Nova realizes he's been chased by a flying Cap and Spidey and figures out that they're robots. And then it's like, Nova smash, you know?
I would have loved it if it was Skrulls or something and he just cuts them in half.
Hilariously, the explosion of the Hulkbot, and no, it's not the now legendary Hulkbot from the Eternals that we love so much, but this Hulkbot's explosion hurls Nova clear out of Shea Stadium and onto a nearby inhabited playground, and I'm guessing presumably kills all the players on the field and injures a lot of the fans in Shea Stadium with that kind of a concussive blast?
It was holograms.
Just then, Nick Fury shows up on the playground. And no, he's not taking his boy to the park. He's looking for Nova. You passed our little test, he tells him.
So he just has $1 million to spend on, like, a test like this?
And not just that. It was, you know, obviously it was S.H.I.E.L.D. LMDs, but Fury put Nova and everyone at Shea Stadium and a playground full of kids at risk just to see what Nova could do?
Now, I think we're going to find out later that Nick kind of fibs about things and covers to make it look like he's more in control. What I think really happened is those LMDs got out of hand. He's backwards justifying it as a test for Nova. Well, when really they were in trouble. But I love the high copter, the high rotor copter style. Like, I don't know if that's ever realistic anywhere, but I just love it.
I thought it was the Thanos copter at first. But Nick says that Tony Stark made these LMD copies of the heroes special for this. And where is the Thor? I think we later see him decades later in Civil War, right? Didn't Tony Stark make the Thor clone?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, I guess so.
Clore.
And that one gets out of control, too, just like these ones did, if your theory holds true, Andrew. All right.
Well, I like that they put that in later. We'll see where Nick, something bad happens, and he just covers it. Like, oh, I knew that was going to happen when he clearly did. This is not the Nick Fury we know, Steve, the man on the wall, as we like to think of him currently.
So Nick explains that they've been tailing Mike Burley and they know Rich is Nova, Rich Ryder, And issue 15 ends with Fury showing Nova who's behind it all, but the reader can't see. And Nova's like, him? Everybody knows him, and agrees to help Fury.
So it's not AIM.
Issue 16's cover is a hot mess. Hot mess.
It's Adam Warlock. Him.
Yeah, right. The cover on issue 16 has none other than the Yellow Claw looking out from his airship at Nova fighting off his jetpack-wearing lime minions while they also attack a tram cable car full of people, and like one dude is falling out to his death, but the perspective is all off with the city like impossibly far below and the angle of the cable car, and is that supposed to be the track it's attached to going across the top, that purple thing, because the angle is of the car is it's a hot mess, man. Hot mess.
At first I thought that was a rooftop with like some kind of vent, but I guess that's something in the water.
I mean, it's taller than the tallest buildings in New York City.
What is happening?
Look, it's claw vision. It's not meant to represent an actual represent. It takes various images and combines them on his claw scope.
Issue 16 opens with Rich's Peter Parker life. You know, tests are hard. He's putting up walls between himself and his friends because of his dual life as Nova. Mac moves in on Ginger.
And you know, I'm here for that. I feel he treats Ginger terribly. And like, he just dumps all over. Why? She should move on. Although the scene where he and Caps, they look like they're dancing.
Well, that's one of those panels of Infantino's art, right? It's like, is Caps trying to trip Rich while he's running by there, or what? Sticking his leg way out to try to get him. As Rich arrives home, he's greeted by his younger brother, Robbie, who tells him that their father has been arrested, and they've got to meet him and Mom down at the police station. And to cap off the Parker luck, Fury calls just then and tells Nova he's got to meet him ASAP and that the fate of the world hangs in the balance. So Rich chucks Robbie aside like Mike Burley usually chucks him around, and he runs upstairs, changes, and flies off to meet Fury. We then get treated to one of my favorite parts of these issues. It's the sight of the Yellow Claw's enormous lair lying 200 fathoms deep off the coast of New York, just beyond the continental shelf. I always thought the Yellow Claw was cool.
All this tech is totally infantine. Like, that's right out of Star Wars. The laser blasts that the guys use, like everything.
Or how about this, the Bottle City of Kandor, you know?
Yeah, I was like very much glad that they didn't kind of rein that part in. Because for me, that's a nice nostalgia trip.
Well, we always like the lairs of the villains, you know? Since, like, the owl's airy.
No cutaway for Kevin, though, so.
No.
The Yellow Claw first appeared in Yellow Claw Comics 1-4, which was from Atlas Comics that ran in 1956 and 1957, written by Al Feldstein and art by Joe Manili originally, but Kirby would take over with issue number 2, and the Claw was like a Fu Manchu-like villain for the series' star, who was Jimmy Woo, a Chinese-American secret agent who was also in love with the Yellow Claw's niece. Then in 1967, Steranko brought both the Yellow Claw and Jimmy Woo into the Marvel Age of Comics in his Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. feature in Strange Tales in issue 167, and it was really a perfect fit for Fury's espionage world. But fun fact, it was just a robot of the Yellow Claw. The real Claw wouldn't reemerge until Captain America 164 in 1973. And then besides this 1977 appearance in Nova, the Claw would also appear in Iron Man in 1975, and in The Invaders in a flashback tale in 79, and in The Avengers in 1981. Then years and years later, he'd show up in the 90s in that Nick Fury title, and although I haven't read it, he apparently and understandably appears in the Agents of Atlas series with Jimmy Woo, although I guess it becomes retcon that he did all of his evil deeds as a way to train Woo to take his place as the head of Atlas, which he created.
They also rename him because of
his
history.
The yellow angle of it, and they named him the Golden Claw.
Yeah, they didn't need to make him yellow. That we got the hint.
But he was cool.
Yes. I do like the fact that he is a master planner, but he's not afraid to roll up his sleeves and get in there, too.
But that's what I like about, even though it's the cliched Fu Manchu type of thing, but I like the idea of this master planner type oriental villain who has the high-tech weaponry and the cool lair and stuff, and I get that all that's hackneyed, but it's still fun. And again, I was 7 reading this stuff, so it's probably the first time I was introduced to it. So back to the Claw's undersea lair, we're also introduced to the Claw's scientist henchman, a Nazi named von Horstbaden, who prefers to be called Fritz von Voltzmann, a character who also appeared in the Yellow Claw series in the 50s. Now, Marv is just showing off, right? And with the German accent and the red spectacles, it was this guy who supercharged the Sandman back in issue 13 and sent him after Mike Burley and all that.
Those old Nazi scientists, Steve. They're always bad news.
The Yellow Claw sends a full regiment of his jetpack-wearing lime minions, his sky squids, as he calls them, to attack Nova and Fury. And they battle in the air, and Fury takes on a jetpack to join in the fight. And the Roosevelt Island tram car is lit on fire, and Nova has to rescue the 5 people on board, which he does, escaping with the last girl in blue just as the tram car explodes, which sends Nova, like, hurling into the water at high speed, where he's thankful his helmet carries an oxygen supply or he'd surely be dead. And I'm thinking, what about the girl? And then
he was able to just off-panel throw her onto the island.
Yeah, that's what it says in the caption box. He's tossed her to safety, but at that speed, with that concussive blast,
he shielded her from the blast, Steve.
It can't be good. I'm just saying.
And this is the segment where Nick screws up in the air and gets rescued by Nova, but he pretends like, oh, it's fine. I knew you would catch me anyways. And then they also, I love the gratuitous comment about how the guy that lost his jetpack will also be saved, so he wasn't sent to his death.
I wasn't sure why Nick bailed out of the helicopter in the first place, but this whole air melee ends when the Claw distracts Nova and Fury with a 100-foot-tall hologram of himself and then blasts them.
That's way bigger than 100 feet again. Unless he's standing on a model city, like he's dwarfing every single skyscraper.
And
they barely come up to his knees.
I like how it's like a Greg Land pinup where the face isn't looking anywhere near the objects of interest in the panel or anything, and it's just looking off panel all weird.
And the mouth is open.
Instead of letting them fall to their deaths, now that they're blasted, the Claw orders his minions to snatch them from the air and bring Fury and Nova to him. And when they awaken, Nova and Fury are strapped into life pods, attached to a rocket with a neutron bomb on board. They'll survive liftoff through the ocean, through the G-forces of achieving escape velocity to reach orbit, and then they'll die when the missile crashes into a spy satellite that the Claw wants to take out. Which,
so not a death pod.
It's a lot of effort to keep them alive just to kill them.
Well, what's also funny is that the point of the neutron bomb is to kill people and minimize physical damage. Yeah, they're using it solely for physical you should have just put a nuclear bomb on there.
And this plan to shoot them into the satellite almost works. Our heroes blast off and achieve orbit and everything, and they're headed for the satellite when a golden mechanical hand is pictured viewing this from far away via a monitor, and he presses a button that diverts the missile from its target to a new one. Washington, D.C. I love the panels of the Claw and Von Holtzman. They're like, what? Huh?
What would they have done?
This is better than the plan we had.
Yeah, their plan was to destroy New York as a way to get everyone to surrender to the Claw so there would be no more war because he would rule over everyone. Seemed like a weak plan, but hey,
yeah,
he's a bad guy.
I started thinking through that plan, and I'm like, wait, what? What's he doing?
Well, no worries for Washington, D.C., because when issue 17 opens, Nova figures out that, follow me here on this, when he flies, he actually rides on electrons, and somehow that gives him the ability to steer the rocket that he's strapped to away from the Capitol and into the Potomac River.
Okay, then.
I mean, it hurts and everything. He's like, he has to strain to do it, but wow.
Yeah, I don't know why he just couldn't say, I'll use my rocket blast to steer the ship to a different coordinate.
Yeah, yeah, like aim his legs out and shoot out.
Yeah, like he's cannonball or something like that, where he's adding force to throw it off target.
Ryder is next seen at school, where his friends are being, you know, now they're being a little standoffish, and he's being an outright jerk.
Yeah, he's really unlikable in these issues.
Some of these issues, though, I realize, all right, the times where he's been unlikable in modern series, I kind of get it, that it's like, all right, that was there all along.
Yeah.
I had forgotten.
Let's say something nice about all these faces. Like a lot of good face work.
What, you like Caps now?
No, Caps is still a bad guy. But I liked all the faces that... You know, because this is all the dramatic scene, so it's nobody's in their long underwear. They're all wearing regular outfits and having to convey the emotions that they're feeling, and it's his family and friends and everything. I just thought it was nice work. I liked it.
He goes to visit his family at the county lockup to see his dad and stuff, and it's more the same. He's confronted by people who care about him, and he just gets all adversarial with them. Fury seeks him out again, and... at first plays the role of, like, the uncle with the guidance providing advice, you know? But then he straps Nova to a ESP machine and almost hemorrhages his brain because he didn't have the data feed set on low like it's supposed to be.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't as tightly run under this Nick Fury as we were led to believe.
It seems like it's a one-man show. I mean, I guess Dum Dum Dugan is off chasing Godzilla at this time.
Well,
with the helicopter,
he's just a robot, Steve, so, you know, you can't rely on him.
Ooh, ouch. With his last scheme to destroy the spy missile a complete failure, the Yellow Claw turns to his next goal, destroying New York City with a giant tidal wave as a demonstration that will then force the world to bend to his will, where it'll be a peaceful utopia, he swears.
Sure. Didn't Namor already flood New York?
Yes.
Multiple times. And also seen are the Claw's two prisoner scientists, Professor T'Kora, who was the Wakandan from Nova number 13 that Nova was trying to help from getting kidnapped, and Mike Burley's brother, Sam. Using some snazzy S.H.I.E.L.D. intel, Fury and Nova disguise themselves and... infiltrate the Yellow Claw's undersea fortress. It's kind of cool. They go to, like, the curio shop, and that leads to a dock in the boat, and the boat becomes a submarine, and then they're permitted access into that submerged citadel of the Claws. And once there, they pretty quickly find and release the caged scientists, and while Fury makes his escape with them, which is all unseen, Nova seeks out and also pretty quickly finds the Claw in his headquarters.
I like how he busts out this giant red dragon throne.
Oh yeah,
thing.
Gotta have one of those. I also
Oh, go ahead, Steve. Sorry.
They're briefly trapped in this closed chamber that begins to flood with water from a pipe in the ceiling, and Nova pulls the ceiling down by that very pipe to escape. And I can't believe he didn't totally doom them. I mean, they're 200 fathoms deep. If water's coming out of the ceiling and I'm that far under the water, I'm not tugging on that because that might be the outer wall, right? I mean, I can't believe that worked, but it does.
Well, I enjoy also for younger readers, if you want a brief update on 1970s pop culture, they are not afraid to pepper this with references to Doug Henning and Farrah Fawcett Majors.
And, you know, I looked up some of these names because I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, funny. Nova confronts the Claw and Von Voltsman, and his approach over three panels reminded me of that scene in Monty Python's Holy Grail where the two guards are standing in front of the castle and the guy is attacking, the knight's attacking from out from the woods, and he's coming across the field and they're watching him get closer, and then you go back to the shot of the guy running and he's still really far away and he's still really far away and he's still really far away, and then all of a sudden he's just right there and he kills them. It takes Nova so long to fly at rocket speed, just like 10 yards.
Well, look, Steve, much like Rich Rider, I'm not really good at science, so I need you to explain how these hydronic rays work.
The Yellow Claw has already pressed the tidal wave button, so New York City is doomed. And that command platform that the Claw and Voltsman are on lifts off and becomes the dragon-styled assault ship that caught Kevin's eye and now attacks our hero. Nova flees with the Claw in pursuit. And when we next see Nova, he's approaching the tidal wave. And it's like, whoa, how'd he get outside? And where's the Claw? Isn't he right behind him? And that's some of that choppy storytelling that I think is Wolfman having to react to the pages that he gets from Infantino, the way that I've see a pattern over a few different instances. Nova tries to push the wave back with his hands, and that doesn't work. Then Fury shows up with this little roofless flying craft equipped with the hydronic cannon that's designed to repel waves. It's a wave smasher, Andrew.
Pew, yeah, pew. This is the part where I was like,
pew, pew.
How does this work again?
Pew, 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 pew. Fury's shooting the wave, pew, 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 while Nova goes back after the Claw. And it's like, oh man, I just left there, and he's got to go back. Underwater, he encounters the Claw's ship, which becomes like a big hypnotic claw face that makes Nova see the Claw's attacking diving squad as dragons and stuff. When he shakes it off, he starts tearing through the Claw's men. He's underwater, but he's like swinging a dude by his feet and knocking out all the other guys and stuff. There's some great underwater fight choreography going on here. So while Nick and now 10 wave-smashing air sleds shoot at a wave that's already shown to be breaking over New York City. I mean, like, way over it. Even if they just knock it out now, it's still going to fall on New York.
Nova, just laser it. It'll be fine.
Pew, pew, pew.
Yeah, you can just shoot water, apparently. Pew, that's, pew, pew. I don't know why we're not, Japan didn't do that in their tsunami a few years back.
It just evaporates the wave.
Nova confronts the Claw and Von Voltsman, but the Claw tricks him into lowering his defenses and shoots him with his psycho gun. And
I did not like, not, I don't want to be negative, but as we turn to 18, I do not like the change in the art team.
Yeah.
You can tell.
There, it's not Tom Palmer. It's mostly Vinnie Coletta with definitely Tony DeZuniga does some too. It's listed, I think it's listed as The Tribe, right?
Yes, yeah. The Tribe.
The Claw and Von Voltsman really work Nova over while he's defenseless and he's all, like, tripping out. And when Nova comes to his senses, he fights back and punches von Voltzmann right off the airship to his death.
Oh, jeez.
And this is another one of those instances where I think Wolfman has to write out of, try to, you know, do some damage control on the sequence that Infantino gives him. Wolfman tries to mitigate the damage, and he says Voltzmann recovered from the punch and forgot that they were in the air and accidentally walked off the ship to his death. Sorry, Marv. No prize for you for that one.
Hey, look, Steve, I can't tell you the number of times I'm fighting a teenage superhero for my henchman boss guy, and I forget I'm on a flying car.
I just put myself in Marv's, like, shoes when he, like, gets the pages, and he's like, Nova just punched this guy to his death.
Also, not so recognizable the dragon part of the ship anymore.
Nova attacks the Claw, but gets hit with a sonic blast from the Claw himself. What did he need the psycho gun for, then? He makes Nova think that he's on fire and burning so that Nova will flee to the water. And while he's in the water, the Claw's ship explodes, so that Nova thinks that the Claw is dead, and I'm guessing that's all part of the psychoblast illusion that, you know, then the Claw is actually escaping.
So is this underwater base still there and they never go back to it?
Right? I'm wondering if in those later appearances, well, no, because the Invaders one was at, the Iron Man was before this. The Invaders one was a flashback that was in 79. The Avengers one was a weird one in the early 80s where he was trying to collect other superpowered females to be his brides. And then that got used kind of as the basis for the later, what was it, like a Atlantis Attacks or one of those ones had the Lemurian, the Lemurian, like priest or king or whatever, trying to use the different Marvel heroines as brides, right? He was collecting the different ones.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, you never use the same lair twice. It's not cool. Like, you know, that one didn't work. On to the mountain lair, the volcano lair next time.
It's like all those lockers where you have all your extra money and uniforms and equipment. Like, there's all these layers around.
Meanwhile,
you just stumble into it.
Fury's squad has, I mean, done the impossible. They reduced the ocean wave down to this little thin thing, but it still packs a punch, and it reaches out and whacks Nick Fury off of the ship and into the drink like it was behaving like a solar flare expanding, not like an ocean wave moving. Fury shows up on another sled, hair all dry, and gives Nova a ride home, you know, having saved the world and all. This issue,
well, just New York City, Steve.
This issue also has a 7-page backup story that shows Rich apologizing and reconciling with both his family and his friends. Or as Cap says, Richard Rider is back among the living. Hey, Kevin, how many times have we said that over the years, right? And the issue ends with Robbie Ryder, Rich's little brother, uncovering a cloaked mystery object that he claims will help him solve the mystery of his brother's behavior.
And the dad, by rolling over on the group that gave him the money, is out on parole. So he decided to do the right thing.
And then he's going to make some bad decisions. Again.
Now, along with Stan Lee, writer Marv Wolfman credits Silver Age writer John Broom among his biggest influences in the medium. And issue 19 of Nova is Wolfman's, like, love letter to Broom. It's essentially a Flash story with a villain the villain would fit right in with the Flash's rogues gallery, Blackout.
That's why this one is better then.
You add in the legendary Flash artist Carmine Infantino and the homage is complete, right?
And Blackout also has some conceptual continuity with our Thunderbolts stuff.
Yep.
But his powers here are just pretty variable.
This one was actually
really pinned down what he can do.
I thought this one was pretty good and creepy. Like, yeah. I always was creep. Blackout was always like a weird guy, and those kind of people that have trouble figuring out reality and everything. It's always a creepy thing because that can happen to anybody.
The Dark Force is always creepy, right? Cloak, the Shroud, Dark Star. When people start slinging their Dark Force around, it's creepy. And how about to finish off the Flash allegories? How about the Wally West cameo when they're in the school hallway? Right?
That's so weird.
He's saying,
"Yeah, that was great." Another humor bit.
So I said, "Barry, you're slowing me way down, or you're slowing down my action." Funny. So oddly, Nova in this issue puts on about, I don't know, 20 pounds of muscle, which makes him look like a bruiser in his 30s instead of a teen who's like used to like riding the bench when they're at the basketball game rather than getting any playing time.
He's been hitting the gym.
Nova's just flying along. He's minding his own business when he gets attacked by Blackout, who's a real talker. And he gets bashed through a wall twice, Nova that is, strangled by Blackout's Dark Force, and then encapsulated in this Dark Force, what would you call it, like a sarcophagus that's like Han Solo in the Carbonite and left to suffocate and die.
It always seemed like it was kind of living. Plus, I think Blackout's asymmetrical outfit is actually kind of, like I said, just I think he's a really good creepy villain, probably also because I don't feel he's overused.
Agreed.
I just like, just a fan of this one. And as you say, it gets creepier and creepier. But yeah, he's crazy.
Nova wiggles free just before his air supply runs out and races to school, where, of course, he's late, which is another shade of the Flash's comics. Barry was always late, despite being the Flash. Blackout returns to the scene of the crime, he calls it, where he was experimented on and cursed with this power that he's stuck with that's also killing him. He encounters the scientists who are in charge there and essentially kills them, assimilating them into the color spectrum.
Do they, like, I'm like, what happened to them? I'm like waiting for Nova to like rescue them later.
Nope.
And everything, I'm like, oh.
See, the guy who became Blackout worked with this lead scientist guy, and when he learned out that he was defrauding the government for his grant money, he was going to speak out about it, so the scientists framed him for a crime he didn't commit, and then the only way to get the charges dropped was to be a guinea pig for the experiment that resulted in him becoming this living Dark Force generator. And then in the Rich and Ginger at the basketball game scene, there's another Infantino pose that makes me cringe. It's like that impossible back-breaking, like there's no weight or gravity involved. Ugh. The guy shooting the basket, it's nuts.
But if Rich stands up, isn't he as tall as, like that basket is low.
Furthermore, Infantino shows Nova saving a girl from an oncoming car by flying and moving the car while it's in motion and picking it up and putting it back on the ground for it to drive off rather than moving her out of the way, which I think, again, is one of these awkward sequences that Marv felt compelled to do some damage control on, with Nova thinking afterwards, hey, it just occurred to me that I could have moved the girl, not the car.
At least he didn't smash the car this time.
The last four pages are round two with Blackout. I like the scene with Nova blasting through like consecutive wall constructs that Blackout makes. And
well, he's using his speed and power to show that like it's good. I mean, from reading all those New Mutant Cannonball comics, I'm used to that power set and the way they reflect it. Also, they put it in a storm, you know, that Blackout's sort of trying to create this scenario where if he comes true, he'll be ultimately powerful, and that always adds some tension to it.
Blackout goes to his finishing move to kill Nova with that whole absorption into the color spectrum thing, but Nova manages to knock him back on his butt, and he sits on his stabilizer, breaking it, so then he, not Nova, disappears into the ether.
No, not like this, not like this.
And that's when Nova...
That guy needed a stabilizer, that's for sure.
And then Nova looks at the broken machine, and he's like, well, maybe if I was smart, I'd be able to fix it, but... Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Issues 20 and 21 bring the whole Inner Circle story to a head. With Dave Hunt inks over Infantino for issue 20, which give a very polished, smooth, clean look. That, I mean, I'm used to seeing Dave Hunt over Byrne, like on the old Iron Fist issues and stuff. And then Bob McLeod and Joe Rubenstein ink Big John Buscema for issue 21, which is a real treat.
Yeah, this is different.
I am not the good with inkers like you are, Steve, but for those of you that have Unlimited, pull up 19 and 20. It's really not, it really shows you like what an inker can do and what a huge difference tonally and image, like it's night and day almost, those two issues. And not just because one was, you know, during a storm at night, but night and day as far as how the final image is composed and everything. I thought it was really nice. Every once in a while when you get one of those and it's back to back, it really helps people like me who aren't as, don't have the fine eye to kind of pick up on things.
We finally get to see what was under wraps in Robbie's room. It's a highly sophisticated Sherlock Holmes robot called Factor X, or Shirley. It's unbelievable.
Isn't that an X-Men thing, Factor X?
And, like, Robbie is as smart as Rich is dumb, right?
What I don't get is why does a robot actually smokes a pipe? I can see giving him a pipe, but... Or is that, like, his exhaust?
Maybe it's a little bubble pipe, yeah.
Like a weird affectation to give your robot.
Their father comes home and totally distresses his wife by saying he's not only decided to testify against the Inner Circle, but he needs to go tell them in person so they can sweat for a while.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, that's what they'll do.
So he goes to their secret hideout, and they're like, hey, listen, you know, we gave you the money, you signed the contract, you did the job, we were there for you when you needed us, you know, what's the deal? And then that becomes...
That's a good point. He is sort of welching on his deal. I mean, did he return the money? No.
And he did the job. There's not, you know, he did, he, you know, and then, of course, that becomes now you're never leaving here alive. But the upper management of the Inner Circle, like the inner circle, decides that they're not done messing with Ryder yet. Meanwhile, Nova busts in on some thugs in a hideout and knocks them around, savagely I might add, for info on the Inner Circle. And again, I think Wolfman has to account for Infantino's sloppy storytelling, having Nova say that the tip he got off-panel paid off as he busts in to get yet another tip. Like, I think this was supposed to be the first tip. But it was such an awkward transition that he's like, okay, I got a tip already. That leads me to... Because then he goes to get another tip and another, you know. It's too long of a chain of tips. Too many tips.
Yeah, this Shuffles character is not doing it for me. Oh,
but before that, how about Nova destroying this guy? Not once, but twice, throwing him head first into a wall with the guy's hands at his sides, totally defenseless? Wow.
Well, Steve, look at that guy. What would you conclude from that guy? How many guys you know wear purple pants, Steve? Maybe guys that wear purple pants that transform into other, more formidable bad guys? Clearly, he thought he was fighting the Hulk.
So this tip leads to the source of another tip from a guy right out of Luke Cage's book, this Shuffles guy. It just makes me glad that Wolfman didn't keep writing Luke Cage.
Yeah. This character is not...
Nova finally arrives at the lair of the Inner Circle, after all his tips pay off. And he gets attacked by a squad of goons in purple hoods with massive static cling on their clothes, as only Infantino can depict.
Not the Secret Empire. Or the Crimson Cowl.
The last goon standing tries to shoot Nova, like, point blank with a machine gun, but Nova grabs the barrel, and the resulting reverse blast takes the shooter out. Nova unmasks him, and it's his dad.
No.
And just then, Robbie and the robot show up, having tracked Rich there. Which I'm wondering if they tracked him, if the robot helped, like, did they go to all of the tip places, too, along the way?
He had to play a card game with Shuffles to see if they would let him go.
No, he let Shirley play. Nova tells Robbie to watch over his father while he tears through the complex looking for the boss. And it's the Corruptor, who we first saw in issue number 4, who turned Thor bad, remember?
Yeah, the Corruptor's way better in this issue.
Doesn't he, though? He's got the more modern, looks like the Grandmaster a little bit.
He closely does his Purple Man controller, like all those guys gag, but still, I think it's still better than that first appearance.
And it makes sense that because Ryder was acting so weird that he was, you know, he was being controlled by the Corruptor, right?
Yeah, but the cover to 21, guys, come on. Richard Ryder is Nova. He's got the helmet down. That's what you remember.
We'll get there. The Corruptor blasts Nova and then explains how his corrupting power will soon spread through the city and cause havoc and chaos that would make a modern-day peaceful protest actually look peaceful.
Why doesn't he keep on doing it, though? It's like Nova stops a few of his guys, and then he's like, oh, I'm going to have to come up with a new plan. Just keep on touching people.
The Corruptor tries to control Nova through this futile dive with gloved hands, right? His powers are chemical and touch-based, and he's diving at him with gloved hands. And when he can't turn him, he escapes into a cloud of smoke. Nova fights his way out through more of the Inner Circle's goons. There's one sequence I love him using his blasting legs like as a whip when he like whips around the pole. It reminds you that there's like a solid construct of his legs underneath that blast effect, you know? And Nova helps his injured dad and his brother to the hospital. Shirley will have to get an Uber. And then Nova seeks out more info from Shuffles. Shuffles knows everything. But he doesn't give him the goods this time. He only tells him that the controlled mob is now forming.
Is there usually Russian trawlers fishing off Long Island coast there and like with no trouble?
Couldn't it just been a fishing boat like at the dock, at the pier? Like it was weird that they were within the 3-mile limit. So like how far out did he go? That was odd. But he gets a fishing net ultimately and uses it to scoop up the angry mob.
Is this a reference to something?
You don't likely remember it. There was a Starkist Tuna had a character called Charlie the Tuna that ran for years.
Sorry, Charlie.
Sorry, Charlie. You don't need a fish with good taste. We need a fish that tastes good. And that ran for years, and so it was just funny that it's like, oh yeah, another pop culture reference.
Weird. And speaking of tuna, all of the people wrapped up in they're still all controlled and hostile and like rioting, right? So they're all just trapped into this ball of flesh and bone and I'm guessing bad breath. So Rich goes to visit his father in the hospital and finds his mom and brother there too. And he takes this opportunity to reveal his Nova identity to them.
They take it pretty well.
This is different from Spider-Man. We're right on.
No one's having a heart attack here.
Yeah.
Wolfman's on record saying he's never been much for secret identities. And, I mean, if you can't trust your parents, right? And, I mean, look at what Wolfman went on to when he did New Teen Titans over at DC. Other than Dick Grayson, who had to keep his secret identity because of Batman's secret identity, all of the rest of them were all known by their regular names. Wolfman never been much for the secret identity.
I always thought, Steve,
in modern times.
that he was angling for 35 years later to work on the major motion pictures when he's super.
And lastly, we get a glimpse of Mike Burley, a fugitive on the run after trying to burgle on behalf of the Yellow Claw. He comes across a derelict in an alley. The guy is really out of it, moaning that he's the Comet. Burley thinks this guy needs medical attention, so he carries him to the same hospital that the riders are in. And during the evaluation, the ER docs order an X-ray over the objections of the patient. They do it anyway, and then he starts glowing. And it's like, next issue, who was the Comet? But for that, we're going to have to wait until our next installment covering this old Nova series from the 70s. So, what you been reading?
Have we talked about these little books before from Tashin?
Oh, I like the little books. How yeah. little?
Because there was a bunch of Marvel ones that came to my attention. And I think I've seen different things like this before. And I'm like, well, is it just a cover gallery? But it's actually pretty in-depth, more in-depth than you would think.
So what Kevin's talking about is something that I picked up. They released a few volumes of them a few different times over maybe the course of 2 years. I remember getting a few for Christmas and then doing the same thing the following year. And they're little, smaller than digest-sized books that have the most intriguing poly fabricated covers to them that have this interesting little texture to them. They're not like paper and they would rip, but they're not full-on plasticky, cheapy feeling either. They have a nice little feel in your hands. And when you flip yeah. through them, it's tons of panels and covers, and a lot of the material is from Roy Thomas's Big Giant, that big $200 50 Years of Marvel History or whatever book. They just pulled things right from that. But I think there's other stuff as well. But there's a Fantastic Four one, I believe, an Iron Man one, a Captain America one, an Avengers Tashin, one. Yeah,
Tashin Spider-Man slices one. That stuff up so great, because I have some of the little DC character focused ones, you know, from that 80 years of DC or whatever. So once they have that material, they'll chop it and prop it in every possible way.
I know it feels kind of fancy because it's something about it. It's not just this is some cheap newsprint thing we just hacked out. Like they put a little bit of thought into it. And then they have even other media in here, like magazines and the movies, and it's meaty. And it's so small too, but there's a lot here. I don't know. I was kind of impressed.
I love, especially because of the durability of the, cover stock. I love throwing them in my pack. If I'm going to be sitting somewhere in a hammock or something like that, or camping or that kind of a thing, because you can whip it out and start it from anywhere and read any number of pages and have an entertaining experience.
I think most of them have the Alex Ross back covers too.
Well, I've got some ones and zeros comics and some paper comics. Which would you prefer to hear about?
I don't care so much about the delivery of the comic as much as the content of the comic. I'm that kind of guy.
That's why we lost you, Steve.
I'm that kind of guy.
That's why we lost you. Paper forever. Digital never. How dare you?
I got this huge iPad now, and I mean, the viewing screen is the same size as a loose leaf paper. My comics look so good digitally now that it has closed the gap.
The paper's so good.
Paper's right. good.
Well, let's go digital to make Steve happy. I've been reading the kind of fun sort of, I like the kind of garbagey crass stuff that comic book companies do. So I picked two particularly ones, and it's not like the comics can be good, but I just love the blatantness. So I picked, it's free, You can get Fortnite, X, Marvel, Nexus War, Thor. So it's a free digital comic, and it's to represent, you know, the Marvel characters being sucked into the Fortnite world. I don't play Fortnite, so I'm probably going to get some of the concepts wrong, but I understand it to be an insanely popular game that you play player against player, and so they can always use different IP to integrate into it. But it's Donny Cates and Greg Land.
Wow.
And it was released at the end of August 2020, and it's free. Like, you can go to Marvel Comics and get it, and it's just Thor and Galactus get sucked into the Fortnite world, where, and when you get sucked in, you like forget who you are, so you can have dumb battles for the game. Again, I don't play the game. Maybe the battles are really cool and sophisticated. So then the other heroes come to rescue them, but they're gonna get their minds wiped too. So at the end, and like all these kind of goofy free tie-ins, first of all, it's like half the size of a regular book, and second of all, there's very little arc or resolution. It's really just like a teaser, best of all. But if you are missing Greg Land, or you're like, you know what would Donny Cates do with some kind of obvious product tie-in?
And well, I think it's,
you
funny,
you want to get it for free.
I think it's funny that it's Cates doing it, and he's doing it with Thor and Galactus, who he has together in his book.
Yeah,
so that's kind of cool.
That's the twist. Like, it spins off from that right into the Fortnite universe. And then the other one I read was another, this one you don't get for free, but it was recently downloaded to the Unlimited app. And this is one of the video game tie-ins. It's the Avengers Black Widow number one for the Gamerverse. So I don't have, I intend on buying the game at some point, but I wait. I let games kind of sit around before I bother to buy them. They get cheaper. So you may have heard there was an Avengers video game that came out. So Marvel's not going to sit around and not let that get turned into, you know, fresh hot IP. So what's fun is it resets the table, obviously. You know, again, I love these. It's Christos Gage, Michelle Bandini, Rachel Rosenberg, Joe Caramagna. And she's on the helicarrier getting trained by S.H.I.E.L.D. But all the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents don't really like her because, you know, she's a Russian. So it's just funny how it's set back in the past, but the idea of it being like, oh, it's this way for people who don't. But I'm like, at this point, she's been in how many of these Marvel, like, who doesn't know who Black Widow is? And if they do, are they really buying a comic? Like, Avengers Endgame was seen by like 90 billion people. Wait, Steve, did you get around to seeing it, or you passed on it?
What? Endgame?
The Avengers. Yeah.
I saw that in the movies.
I didn't know if you had gotten it. I know sometimes you wait or whatever, but... So I just feel like it's always... I mean, I don't care about reboots and all that stuff, and it's fun. Especially because this is Nick Fury Jr. in this one.
Oh, boy.
It was more famous than the other. But the whole point is, no one trusts her, but she trains with this guy who has a nice attitude and like is trying to work with her. And then it finds out that she betrayed them and was going to let all the prisoners loose. And then she turns the table and proves that, you were the one that was setting me up.
Wow. And you really escaped. Read this thing.
And his last name is Masters, you know, Taskmaster.
Wow.
So it's a reboot of him too. But Nick Fury then pulls the gun on her and he's like, yeah, he set you up, but we saw that you had cased the joint. And then she explains that, like, one of her old, there's an old Russian ballet dancer who's in S.H.I.E.L.D. prison, and she wanted to just let him go, not all the bad guys. And Nick, as a faith of trust, says, like, lets him go, and says, like, oh, it's a shame you died. And he's like, what? And, like, the Black Widow sets him up with a new identity and everything. So it shows that they're, you know, forming that bond. And then it ends how it's continued in Marvel's Avengers, coming soon for PS4, Xbox One, Stadia, and PC. Kevin, you're an IT guy. What's Stadia?
Something people don't play.
Well, you can play Avengers on it. Yeah, I just... anytime I see this kind of weird standalone or promotional or goofy stuff, I don't know. I like the weird world of it. I wish they solve more fights with Hostess fruit pies, or the Justice League had like this Snaplock tools tie-in with something comics, or and the Turtles do something with KFC. Anytime there's any one of these, I find them endlessly good. They remind me of those old days. They're fun. I mean, they're real working professionals doing this stuff. We know Christos Gage and Donnie Cates and Greg Land and all them. So, yeah, it's just a fun, humorous look at some Marvel stuff.
As long as Del Rusk doesn't show up.
Do you think we're ever going to see this Black Widow movie?
Yeah. 2021.
All right. I'll be there at the drive-in.
Hey, you could have seen... Did you see the New Mutants movie, Steve?
No.
It never came out.
Wasn't at the drive-in.
It was here, but I just didn't feel like it was... I don't know. I was like, well, if we could have gotten another movie paired with it that I wanted to see, I would have done the double feature thing. But it was just... On all the other movies at the drive-in, I'd never heard of. Because obviously they're not releasing a lot of big movies.
It was at the... I think it was probably one of the first new movies to be released in our theaters.
I mean, like I said, they have these new movies, but they're ones I just haven't heard of, which makes me think they're pretty obscure. You know, there's always movies there, and I'm like, sometimes it's a revival, but a lot of it's just new films that, you know, foreign imports or small budgets or something. But I'm like,
well, they had Bloodshot in the theaters again.
Oh, well, yeah, my current location is not open to indoor theaters, so it's only drive-in theaters where in my current county.
Us as well.
So I'm paradoxically ahead of you guys and behind you guys at the same time.
Yes. That is true. I don't know whether you're coming or going, Kevin.
I got something else.
What'd you got?
I got some manga.
This is Marvel noise. This is Marvel noise.
it's so weird that I return to that. Like time again, and I'm like, I like need more of this. It's that weird era of Marvel. It's like they're doing Marvel imports in print, and it's Spider-Man. I think it's from the 70s. There can't be a high print run on this. I just can't imagine. But they go into a whole like story at the back of this issue. On like, oh, we wanted to like break into the Japanese market, and you know they had all these challenges, and they're like, well, what if we get someone over there to like reinterpret it? And then they're like, yeah, we like this Spider-Man concept, but they only like a very small portion of like what Spider-Man is. So it seems like they looked at like, with great power must come great responsibility, and they're like, oh, we don't need that. We'll just toss that thing in the trash. So it's a unique take on Spider-Man. But what's funny, it says translation in here, C.B. Cebulski, and this is December 1997. So this is a $3.99 U.S. comic in 1997, because you're getting a double-sized issue. So I imagine this is probably like two episodes from the magazine it like premiered in Japan. And this is all, I say it's all black and white, but I have a sneaky suspicion that the first, say, 20 pages were probably in color, because it looks very like painterly in spots. Like there's way more like tone and like brush strokes and all this extra detail, but it's just reprinted here in black and white, so I'm thinking that's probably color. So of course, like, you have your Peter Parker in here, They don't call him Peter Parker. And then he gets, like, involved in, like, a radioactive accident, and then he becomes Spider-Man. It's kind of, in a way, like the 60s cartoon in that sense. Like there's parts from the comics, but you can obviously tell, like, there's this weird, like, that cartoon. It's just, like, some weird alternate thing going on. And then you see some of, like, you get introduced to, like, parts of his cast and everything, and he's like, oh, I gotta come up with the costume, the whole thing. But there's not really a lesson. Like, I guess they weren't a fan of Uncle Ben either. Much like the movie, Uncle Ben, not an essential element of Spider-Man. And then the first villain here is Electro, which is actually kind of nice when everything becomes, like, more simple, more cartoonish, less detailed. I guess you got to get those pages out, right? Like, if you need to get out, I don't know, like, your 18 pages a month or whatever to meet the deadline.
Yep.
So I guess someone is, like, his name isn't Peter. What's his name again? Whoever he like, he's corresponding with someone over the mail. And then they meet up, like, towards the end of this reprint in this issue here. And I guess this is supposed to be the Mary Jane character, maybe?
Did you say...
It's just very weird trying to
Are they in color or black and white?
No, this is all reprinted in black and white.
Okay.
Which is why I'm thinking this is a very strange comic for, like, 1997. Like, things are going into, like, down in the industry. Things aren't great. And then you have this, like, weird, expensive, oversized, black and white Japanese Spider-Man comic. Like, but I must have more. It is. And then they also did, I think, an X-Men one around this time, but that's not from, like, it wasn't originally produced in the same era. And apparently there's a Hulk one too, but that's, for my research, it seems to be, like, that one's, like, the rarest of the rare. So I don't know if Marvel could reprint these at any time, but I would totally, like, want to see more of that stuff.
Well, 97 would have been right out of bankruptcy, so maybe they were grabbing whatever they could or that type of thing. I have a very similar book, Kevin. Something from the 90s that reflects the 70s. You guys remember this? The original Ghost Rider.
Whoa.
Nice. How original?
Western Ghost Rider.
How original are we talking?
We're talking Volume 1, Number 1, 1992.
Oh.
Which is reprinting from the 70s. 1972. So it's edited by Stan Lee and Gary Friedrich, conceived and written, and Mike Plug. So it's a reprint book, which I have fondness for. What I ended up with, I'm buying job lots of comics off of eBay to finish up 2099. And bought some Ghost Rider, and this was a big lot that had a bunch of other Ghost Rider stuff in it.
Cool.
So I was not aware of this reprint title at the time. Because for me, I think of reprint titles from the 70s and 80s. And I didn't realize they continued into the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
That's totally cool. Like, I like... This was the time, you know, before digital. Marvel did do trades, but not like they would come to do. So it was a cheap way to get collected information.
And the new Ghost Rider was such a big hit, and they were bringing back Blaze. So they wanted to... you know, explain and teach people who the original Ghost Rider was. Although, not the original Ghost Rider. The original Ghost Rider, they changed his name to the Knight Rider. He was the white cowboy on the horse, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's fun for me to go back to this stuff. And I would imagine in 92, it must have been awesome. I don't know how available, you know, depending on where you were. I was not in a great place for back issues, you know. I mean, we had some, but it was kind of whatever was there was there. So this would have been the perfect way for me to catch up on what's a great story. I had forgotten that the original one these first few issues, because I have a bunch of them, it's Satan that he's calling. Like, yep. They ended up changing it to the spirit, like all that other stuff.
Mephisto.
But well, wasn't it Zarathar, that guy for a while? The Zarathos.
That was at the end of the first series.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, it's interesting how the different people morph. Plus, you guys would have preferred this over the original, because this one has the coolometer in it. So.
Nice. I also like the covers on those. I bought that reprint series. It was cool.
Yeah, and then the other one that was in the job lot thing was Ghost Rider 25, which was, again, I remember buying the first couple issues. This is the new Ghost Rider.
Is that the cover thing with the crazy?
Yeah, with the skull and the face melting on it. And this was from 92 as well. So like you say, I remember when this first came out. I wouldn't have probably didn't last 25 issues in, but I remember the oh my gosh, a new Ghost Rider with a new motorcycle, like a fancier motorcycle than the kind of old style chopper that Johnny Blaze wrote, and Howard Mackey, Ron Wagner, Mike Witherby.
Yep.
And this one features, it's just all fighting pretty much. Like, it starts with him taking on basically who looks like Nam. I don't think it's the same guy, but it's like this roided out Rambo looking dude, and Ghost Rider wipes the table with him. I was unfamiliar with where we were in the story, but this is the one where we have the firm that wants to. The firm is a group of shadowy weapons dealers who want to kidnap Ghost Rider so they can weaponize him and make biological weapons. So they sent that character, they sent the Nam, like the Vietnam vet looking muscular dude after him, even though they knew he would fail, but that way they could collect data. So who do they hire to go after Ghost Rider? But Blackout.
Wait, you mean that Blackout?
Yeah, the vampire, ugly looking one, and they're like, we'll fix your face that Ghost Rider messed up if you take out the Ghost Rider. They don't trust him, and so they put a bunch of bugs and spies, and he kills all the security measures they put on Blackout to stop him. Fail. He just murders them. And then he starts taunting our new Danny Ketch, the new Ghost Rider, calls him and says he's going to kidnap all his family and friends, and if he turns into Ghost Rider, he'll kill him. So,
wait, do villains fight over the same name?
Yeah. Well, this is the 90s edgy Blackout. So he chases down Danny. Danny refuses to change, so Blackout kills him. He drinks his blood. And that leads to the craziest triple page spread, the fold out section.
Oh, yeah. So I remember that.
It folds out so it goes above the page. So the Ghost Rider's head and arm actually extend above. So I went to Unlimited. It's not, unfortunately, this issue isn't on Unlimited, because I'm like, how the heck would this scan in? But it is very like the middle cardstock fold out triptych. With Blackout and Ghost Rider standing over Danny's body. He's left the body to fight Blackout. Yeah. So part of why I wanted to do this was I had to see this crazy spread in fancy printing and everything. And then, you know, he obviously Ghost Rider defeats Blackout and takes out the guy from the firm who set him up, blah, blah, blah. But the big status quo is, oh no, he can't turn back because Danny will die. And then they also feature a tease for Spirits of Vengeance, which is them teaming up. And we have a March coolometer. I mean, you guys must have loved this. The cool stand soapbox. The thing? And they have a bunch of pinups in the back. The coolest thing is Nomad.
Really?
And then Christopher Columbus. Yeah, 92
what?
Was maybe a different. So, yeah, just pinups of, like, Morbius in, like, his weird green outfit, which I don't remember. The Darkhold, which I like, because that was them. Namor with, like, looking like right before the torch took him to get his memory back. Night Stalkers. Yeah, I didn't know if you guys remembered this triple page triptych.
Yeah.
All right. I just dug the issue out down here in the bunker, and I'm, oh, whoa, man. the middle section that pulls out, it's heavier stuck than the cover.
Yeah. It's this weird card. But when I didn't know it. So the pages are actually smaller because it's kind of the fold out is folded in.
Right.
So you're like, wow, wait, what is this? And then you fold it out and it flips up like a pop-up book. It's great. I mean, you know, this was in a job lot, $275 cover. I don't know what it would cost, but it was worth all the laughs for me.
Is your cover enhanced in any way?
It looks like it's got kind of a little bit of a...
Just that silvery sheen to it, right?
Silvery sheen, yeah, that's
that,
it.
All right. No, I guess the enhanced aspect was that middle section. Because I know whenever there was an enhanced cover, and they offered a non-enhanced version, I bought the non-enhanced version, so I wasn't sure if I... Nope, mine's $275 too, so...
Yeah, this one. But yeah, the fold-out is worth the price. Like, I'm just sad it's not on Unlimited, because I wanted to see how they would deal with that. But maybe that's why they're not going to be able to put it on. And then the pinups in the back. Yeah, just 90s excess, crazy printing, crazy stuff.
They must have got me with that because I don't have a lot of Ghost Rider issues, but I distinctly remember that issue.
The fold out a lot, like everyone at the... That should have been on the Cool-O-Meter. Forget Nomad.
And the next issue was the crossover with the X-Men.
But I got a bunch of those issues, so I might sit and read some of them. Oh, but I had to jump to 25 when I saw the weird extras.
Let me know which ones. Maybe I'll join you.
Well, they sent me bagged copies, like never been opened. So I'm like, how do I open these?
Man, so don't wreck your investment.
I do have the Rise of the Midnight Suns, Ghost Rider and Blind Spirits of Vengeance, still bagged with my bonus poster.
Nice.
Whoa, that might be worth something now.
And also Midnight Suns Ghost Rider number 31 bagged with a bonus poster. So, you know, how could I possibly open these up? I mean, you know, I bought them in a job lot.
That's fine.
Clearly they're, you know, priceless. But anyways, that's just some silly stuff that I've been reading till I get back to the comic shop someday.
I caught up on the end of a few of the different series that we had kind of previously talked about on the show, but was happy to kind of close the loop and finish off the arcs. Like, I finished up the Thor and Galactus, Donny Cates arc, which finished with issue number 6, which was, well, it was weird. It ended with this whole big, dark, look into the future kind of thing that Thor is now going to be all melancholy about. Because in issue 7, which has art by Aaron Cooter, first you got Thor trying to make amends with Beta Ray Bill, and Bill's all like, you remember you just beat the crap out of me and broke my hammer like a few issues ago, like, and now you're trying to act like we're buds here, you know, like you, which goes to the how out of character Thor has been, and now you're trying to write him in character, and it seems weird because you just took him so far away from his center kind of thing. But there's also a funny bit in Thor 7 where I don't know if Thor is actually unworthy or he's worried that he's unworthy again, but he has to rid himself of Mjolnir, and he throws it down to Earth, where of course someone's going to pick it up, right? But inscribed on the side of Mjolnir, it says, "Call Tony Stark," and lists a phone number, 212-970-4133. So, I called it. Because I get,
when, of course you did.
When we grew up, Andrew, the standard fake phone number to have on in TV, if it was viewable, or in a comic book, it would be Dial-A-Joke. Like, you call up and it would be Dial-A-Joke. Remember when there were the weird phone services like that? Like, you could call up and get the weather, or you could call and get the time. How weird was that?
I was always very wary because if I ever dialed a toll line accidentally, you wouldn't be talking to me today. So I had to be very careful that there was going to be no charge on the phone.
And then once Dial-A-Joke went away, they went to that 555-555-555 thing for a lot of the references to phone numbers. But here, when you
call... still use the 555 thing.
When you call this number, though, which is why I read it out loud, you get Tony Stark, his answering machine. It's really funny and worth doing. A kind of a clever thing that they did there.
Yeah, wait till you get your phone bill, then I'll call Steve.
Then I finished out on the Empire material, which was Captain Marvel number 21, where Carol finishes up her duties as the chief accuser of the Kree, and she gives the, you know, she also had this thing of like what to do about this Kree half sister that she has who's a fugitive. She gives her the hammer that once belonged to Ronan, and now her sister is the new lead accuser for the new Kree Skrull Empire led by Hulkling. And Hulkling and who was the name of the Vision and Scarlet Witch's son, who was the non-son? Oh, Wiccan, right?
Wiccan
and Hulkling finally get married in Empire Aftermath Avengers. And then in Empire Fallout Fantastic Four, I like how they did that alliteration, Fallout Fantastic Four and Aftermath Avengers. In the Fallout Fantastic Four, they meet up again with the Profiteer who controlled the gambling planet that had the Kree and Skrull children that now the Fantastic Four have as like adopted wards. And she tries to make a pitch for securing those children back. And fortunately, the Fantastic Four keep them. And then there is a funeral on the blue area of the moon for the Kree and Skrull warriors from the old X-Men 137 who still were fighting each other instead of fighting with each other for the same goal. They were fighting against each other because they could never let their old allegiances to their former empires go. They mix their ashes together in a nice... unification type ceremony. But because it's on the blue area of the moon, Kevin, we get more Nick Fury on the wall as the watcher guy. And there's a little twist at the end because they're wondering where these weapons came from. They can't find the origin of them. And after everybody leaves, the Nick Fury guy who's trapped on the moon there is like, where do these Kotati weapons come from? And he has a moment, we'll say, that ends the issue, and it says the beginning of the end. So I'm guessing the next big thing is going to come out of Nick Fury's old eye hole.
Wow.
Now, are we sure it's still pronounced Empire, Steve? I feel like with that Y, we should like Empire or something like that. You know?
And then the last issue related that I read was the Immortal She-Hulk one-shot that was written by Al Ewing, of course, with John Davis Hunt art. And this is post-Empire where, spoilers, she died and was resurrected, which isn't too much of a stretch based on this whole Immortal Hulk thing. And this book goes through the steps of really tying her origin and her existence to the whole Immortal Hulk Green Door down below thing, and to the current arc involving the Leader. So if you're reading Immortal Hulk, you should probably read this Immortal She-Hulk one-shot, even if you didn't read the Empire book.
There's a lot of Immortal one-shots coming out lately.
Oh, yeah? What else?
Like they had the Zero issue that has some of reprinted material from
the Zero issue.
Peter David and Matt Lowe.
It's the Zero issue reprinted of Incredible Hulk. Or minus one when they did those. That's what it was. But hey, it moved up one. It went from minus one to zero.
It's true.
And so then if we cross that over with one of the point issues, do we have to do a lot of complicated math?
As long as it's not point like LM or something, right? Like when they put the letters after the point, like they're doing that now with the new Spider-Man thing where it's going to be Spider-Man and Spider-Man point, like two letters that are the initials of whatever the mini event is. Like, that's bogus.
No one's going to remember that. Like, I have trouble going back to the 80s and remembering which title is the reprint title, which title changed to, like, I can't keep that stuff straight. Like, it's difficult.
Just call me. I'll help you with that stuff. If it's, if it's from the 80s.
And then there's
know.
the Thrashing Place one shot that's, I don't remember who the artist is, but it's written by Jeff Lemire.
Nice.
I do have a quick shout out for one thing that I just get more and more excited for with each month. It's funny enough, Ewing is here again with Cabal on art for most of that series with Takara with issue 6. This feels really like the Guardians. Like I don't know what, like it's kind of a downer at times, but kind of like heavy character stuff. Like number 5 goes really into some Moondragon continuity, because remember we have like the two Moondragons,
right?
And then Cabal kind of does this thing where he breaks off from the standard storytelling stuff, and like he shows off in impressive fashion his style and all this crazy Moondragon stuff that I'm loving.
Nice. I have that on deck to read, so I'm looking forward to that.
I think Kate's was more like high concept action adventure stuff. And while that was good, it was kind of, I don't know, maybe for me it was kind of diminishing returns after a while. So this, I wouldn't say this, like, that was still pretty good. I think better than what I enjoyed the Dugan stuff. So I find like this is another level of like Guardians goodness, where you have like two teams. Maybe it's something with comics and two teams, right? The team splits off, and then even the Guardians has a history of like having multiples of characters.
You love those for X-Men each other. Books. They got that split thing too.
So good.
Nice. And that'll do it for this episode's excursion into excellence. Thanks, Andrew and Kevin, for coming on and doing another episode. We'll get to the next one right away so we can get to some of the Halloween fun we have coming up. Love reading spooky comics this time of year. For WWX Kevin and Andrew the LA Rabbit, I'm Steve Raker. We'll be back for more in 2 weeks. So until the Corruptor and the Purple Man hold hands and teach the world to sing, make mine marvel. Later.
And drink a Coke.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honey bees and snow white.